This is a very strange and frustrating story. To have your family member stolen, murdered, then missing.
I'm Connie Walker, and this is Missing and Murdered, Finding Cleo.
It's such a mystery, such an impossible task. Please, help us find her.
Finding Cleo. If you'd like to hear more, you can find the full season wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Damon Fairless. When it comes to pop culture highlights, 2023 did not disappoint.
I just have never felt this way about anything, the way that I feel about this experience that we have had and continue to have.
I'm good for this company. I'm good for us. You know, we all vote. We keep control. We don't, then everything's over forever.
Uh-huh. Cap. No cap, that movie is amazing. That means no lying, you know. Yeah, it's like I'm telling the truth. Yeah? Okay, well, how many more of these? There's like four.
Angela Bassett did the thing. Viola Davis, my woman king.
The lesson is to stop inviting you places.
But you can't. Because people want the content.
Are you guys ready?
We are ready.
For Barbenheimer, because today
that is just a taste of our pop culture diet last year. To dig into this sumptuous feast, I'm joined by culture writer and podcaster Nico Stratus and Elamin Abdel Mahmoud, host of CBC's Commotion. Hey, Nico.
Hi, Damon.
Hey, Elamin.
Hey, Damon.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, pleasure.
Appreciate it.
So happy to be here.
Let's start with the weirdest pop culture bit in my brain, at least, George Santos. So, New York Republican.
That's where you want to start?
Little bit of a penchant for lying, booted from Congress earlier this month. He's facing a federal indictment of 23 counts. It could lead to years in prison, but at this exact moment, he's cashing in on his considerable talent as a attention vampire on his notoriety tour. It's doing quite well. And it's actually kind of bonkers that this is pop culture, right? So, Elamin, you're up first. What gives? Why is George Santos, his transformation to D-list celeb so fun to
First of
talk
all,
about.
He's way higher than D-list. I mean, like, I think at minimum B-list. George Santos is interesting to me because he's kind of like an HBO show in 1 year, right? Like, he got elected in November 2022. He got sworn in January 2023. This calendar year, he gets kicked out of the House. This calendar year, he starts a burgeoning career as a cameo artist, which is like the thing where you pay a celebrity $400 and they record a little video for your family.
My favorite TS song is definitely going to be Trouble. I knew you were trouble when you walked in. That's me. Bye.
And then he closes out the year with that interview on Z-Way, who's the comedian slash truth teller of our time. And Z-Way tries to hold him to account. And George Santos's best answer to Z-Way when Z-Way said, how can we get you to go away? And he was like,
stop inviting me to your gigs.
This man is fully aware of the kind of media monstrosity that he is. There's already a book about George Santos. That book is being adapted into an actual HBO series. It's like HBO on HBO, Nico.
What do you think, Nico? What does it tell us? What, like, the joy we're getting, the Elamin's apparent almost giddiness at talking about? What does this tell us about, like, what are we getting from this? What does it tell us about the cultural moment?
I mean, there's a really easy dopamine hit with somebody like him, right? Because it's like you want this like caricature of a human life that we can all sort of point and laugh at and be like, isn't this ridiculous? While simultaneously wonder, how did we get here without ever looking at what the, like, it's one hand never watching what the other hand is doing. This thing of like, stop inviting me to things. Stop paying the guy money on Cameo to say things that you wrote. It's like he's reading an audiobook you're writing $400 at a time. Like, the whole thing just sort of feels ridiculous, but it speaks to people's desire to have something like a little court jester they can point and laugh at, who's like actually, like, you know, has done a lot of really terrible, bad things, but we can easily forego those things. It's the, like, when Rudy Giuliani was on The Masked Singer, it's the same idea of like, what if we take this bad person and make him dance for us for a little while?
So, okay, this is not America's, you know, first rodeo with a politician who some people say may or may not have a
who you're referring to? Who are you talking about?
I'll leave that to you.
Okay, got it.
But Like, do you think we've not learned anything about how to engage with these folks? Like, are we guilty in being complicit in this? Are we, like, feeding the bears, so to speak, the wild animals?
Yeah. I mean, like, it's basically an ascendancy of con artists, right? Like, there's a real interest that we have in turning politics into an entertainment show. I like, not to get Marshall McLuhan about this, but this is literally what he was. I'm gonna do it. But like, this is literally the kind of politician that you get, right? Because like the whole point about the medium is the message is that the medium ends up transforming the message, and the politician of the internet age is, of course, someone like George Santos, someone who thrives in the environment of, like, I don't know, maybe that is true, maybe it's not, but I can just say slay the Boots house down and then everyone's going to laugh about it.
You know why I love the Gen Z progressives?
I'll tell you why,
because they're the future and they need to slay the Boots house down in the future so that this country can stay functional.
What does slay the Boots house down mean?
Conquer everything.
And like sort of like telegraph awareness of memes, and that be sufficient to keep you in the, you know, in the zeitgeist. And people keep coming up to you being like, yeah, we should do more interviews with this person. We have not only have we encouraged this, we have actively sought it out. I mean, literally, people are paying $400 per cameo to be like, George Santos, can you just say happy birthday to my friend, but say it in a funny way?
Happy birthday to you.
And we're willing to do that. That is the thing that people want, some people want out of politicians.
Is it wrong then that I got that for both of you?
that's the last half of the show. It's just
that would be the nicest Christmas present anyone has ever gotten me.
Okay, enough about George Santos. He's obviously taking up enough of our collective space. Yes. As is. Let's move on to movies. So there've been, I don't know if you heard, but movies weren't great for a bit because of COVID.
I heard.
Oh, you did? Okay. Yeah. So then this summer, two big old movies came in and changed that. They breathed life into the box office.
Can you hear the music, Robert? Yes, I can.
I'm just kidding. Anywhere else I'd be attending.
Barbenheimer is what I'm talking about, of course. Mm. The cultural phenomenon surrounding Barbie and Oppenheimer shared cinematic release date. So in a recent interview, Christopher Nolan, the director of Oppenheimer, said that was his most successful film ever. R-rated, 3 hours long, partly in black and white, and about potential nuclear Armageddon. Mm. And yet, it did really well, along with Barbie. So I guess, Elmine, I'll throw this to you. We recently did an episode on the show about how the Marvel Cinematic Universe is showing signs of sputtering. Mm. And these two movies are doing great. What do you think that's telling us about what moviegoers want to see?
Oppenheimer is, to my mind, at this point, the movie that has been sent from above for the Oscars, for the Academy, to give Best Picture to, because this is a movie that people actually saw, because so much of the criticism of the Academies is like, you guys keep giving the Best Picture award to movies and nobody sees. And they've been trying to change that to sort of become a bit more populist. Well, this is a movie that is critically acclaimed, but also at the exact same time, people saw it. And like, you don't get that kind of, you know, confluence very often. But would we really be viewing Oppenheimer in the same breath as Barbie if they weren't opening the same day? And you had this like pastel colored palette right next to this like black gothic, there's a bit of fire in the background palette. I'm not sure that you would. Listen, Christopher Nolan is always going to have his fans. I am one of them. If Christopher Nolan has 100 fans, I am still one of them. But having said that, I'm not convinced that a biopic of a scientist who is responsible for the atomic bomb automatically lends itself to a cinematic event of the year. It is the Barbie counter effect that made it seem like, oh, it's a meme to go see both of those movies. And then people did exactly that.
All right. Nico, let's talk about Barbie.
Yeah, sure.
We've had a bit of distance. What do you think the Barbie craze is all about?
Barbie is an interesting phenomenon because I do think that, you know, Elmine is talking about this Oppenheimer effect. And I think they're both sort of like feeding into the energy of the other. And I wonder what a world looks like where Barbie comes out independently of it playing opposite to Oppenheimer, which is like this, like the black and pink of it all, right? This very, you're playing it against something very stark and you're presenting this world that's very like bright and pink and bubbly. And it is like, you know, it is this subverted idea. Like how many people were like, they made a Barbie movie. How could they possibly do that? It's like subverting this expectation of like, what are we getting out of like a very expensive movie and a flagship title and all these sorts of things. And like, you know, I do sort of wonder did people really watch Barbie, or did people go to Barbie for the event of it, right? Mm-hmm. To take photos in the lobby, to make memes on Instagram, mm-hmm. to do all the ephemera around the Barbie movie. But it's less of a like real conversation as everything else about it. And it's like, it is this interesting view of a film where it's like, no, people don't even talk about what happened in the movie anymore. They just talk about the detritus around it. Whereas like Oppenheimer is a movie about a thing, and it's about a terrible thing, but it's about a thing and it has a point. And like, it is this very different, they're working as opposites in every sense of the word.
Were there other movies this year that you paid attention to, or think we need to pay more attention to, or that you just found really good?
I really like that we got a lot of Godzilla properties this year. Yeah. And like, I say that and people will sort of laugh at me, but I genuinely think it's true. Like Godzilla Minus One, which like Godzilla, another movie that subverts these expectations, right? You think it's a big monster movie. Godzilla is a movie about nuclear devastation in Japan. And it's about a post-nuclear Japan. And it's about all these things. And, you know, this was sort of like the Japanese maker of this franchise really taking it back and doing something really big and bold with it. And like, we have the show on Apple TV, and like, it's an interesting universe that's getting its due.
For me, the movie that I delighted in the most was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, so good.
That was made in the summer. Yeah, I love that so much because it sort of re-understood what the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, actually as a franchise is about.
It came up on the comic book.
Well, this is it. It's like the previous attempts to make the Ninja Turtles into movies or into different properties, they've kind of taken the wrong thing, which is to say like, hey, they're turtles, but also they're ninjas. And I'm like, no, these are a bunch of lonely teenagers who are just trying to connect with a bunch of people around them and maybe eat pizza, on the way there.
Really sorry, Splinter. Some of the guys wanted to get pizza and I tried to talk them out of it.
Leo!
You ratted us out.
Hey! Don't use that word that way.
I mean, it's 2023.
And this is the movie that captured that energy so much. It was about that loneliness. It was about the way that they are isolated. And that's the thing that made you connect with them, you know, when we were younger. Like, sure, I get it. Like, they have cool weapons, but also they're really funny. And they're allowed to be really funny.
Yeah.
And I got to say, Ninja Turtles opened A, right after Barbenheimer, and then B, in the middle of the strike, in the middle of the writers and actors strike. Mm. And so as a result, it didn't get the same kind of promotional push that the other movies did. And that is a shame. So if you get an opportunity, like, you got to go back and watch the Ninja Turtles from this year, because it was so good.
Great soundtrack, too.
Such a great soundtrack. Well, especially for 90s people.
Yeah, you know? if you're 40 years old, great soundtrack to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. And it was stylish, too, right? This idea, you know, we're talking about the MCU earlier, and like, this and like Across the Spider-Verse and all these things, they're not afraid to make a comic book thing look like a comic book and be stylish and have a visual identity that has something to say, as opposed to like, look at all our VFX artists.
Hey, it's Jeff Blair.
And I'm Kevin Barker.
Join us for in-depth coverage on everything surrounding the Toronto Blue Jays and the biggest stories across Major League Baseball with the best guests in the game and, of course, first-class analysis.
Ha! That's the smartest thing you've ever said, Jeff.
See what I have to put up with? It's Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're kind of going to talk about the box office for a second, but we're going to segue super smoothly, if I have anything to do with it, into music.
Let's go.
Okay, so two big box office juggernauts, Beyonce.
Woo, I'm out of breath.
Taylor Swift.
Welcome to the Eras Tour.
With their movie tour thingies.
Yes.
But also, they're doing pretty well as musicians.
Doing okay.
They're doing okay.
Not bad.
They boosted the economy with billions of dollars. Yeah. They had, you know, sold out international shows. And then, of course, there's the box office hits. Elamine, do their parallel successes tell us anything about one another? Like, I see them orbit, these two stars orbiting each other.
I think there's a couple of factors. First of all, thank you so much for asking me about Taylor Swift and Beyonce. This is my favorite day on earth. I think there's a couple of reasons why we think of them together. First is that like the Taylor Swift origin story is intimately tied with Beyonce, which is tied to that episode when Kanye West went on stage and he took the microphone out of Taylor Swift's hand.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you were there, pal. I think you remember it.
I know what you're
It was like that moment, you know, taking the microphone out of her hand and saying like,
I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Taylor Swift kind of looking there and like, well, I don't know what to do with this. And at the end of that episode, at the end of that award show, Beyonce coming up, receiving the big award of the night, bringing Taylor Swift up to finish her speech.
So I'd like for Taylor to come out and have her moment.
And like, I think we kind of like have intimately connected the two of them from that moment on. And then from there on, I think the two have kind of become the main accomplishers in two different artistic arenas. For me, Taylor Swift is a sales juggernaut. No one can really sell like Taylor Swift. She is one of the last sort of artists, probably the last artist who can kind of sell, put up numbers like she puts up. Mm-hmm. And then Beyonce has sort of managed to achieve stuff that is entirely different category. Beyonce sells a lot still, but it's her artistic achievement that we talk about. The idea that like Beyonce's kind of pushed her genre and pushed pop music to an entirely different level, that pushed like the meticulousness to a different level. And those two are always competing, right? Like this idea of art versus commerce, do you have to compromise one in order to have the other one, which is why we think of them as in conversation with each other. Other than that, I'm not actually sure that they're particularly in conversation with each other. What's your read, Nico?
I mean, not musically. I wouldn't say like, no. You know, they're both pop stars. And I think we like to flatten the idea of what pop music is to be like, oh, they're both pop musicians. So they both exist in this shared universe. But I do think that they are making drastically different things in a pop space. This is like, I know that there's been a lot of pushback about the idea of poptimism in the last couple of years, especially, but like, you know, this is why we sort of are supposed to have deeper critical conversations about pop music, mm-hmm. because we can actually differentiate between these things. And like, it's undeniable that it's been a big year for both of them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Taylor Swift did get Person of the Year from Time.
Yeah.
And she was given that quote for spinning her story into global legend. So Nico, like, what is the story? What is the story she's spinning into global legend?
Yeah, Nico.
What's she been successful at selling?
Tell us.
I mean, she's really good at selling this sort of neutral landscape that you can draw yourself into. Like, I was talking about this with somebody yesterday, and I was saying it's like when you get a placemat at Applebee's, and they give you a couple of crayons, and they say, draw yourself into this.
Nico Stratus.
So she is.
I'm not saying that this is a bad thing, necessarily.
No, but she's the... I mean, that's what like, so much... mass like literature is the protagonist is this blank slate that you pop yourself into and then you're living their life.
You know, way you guys are holding me back right now is the Swiftie in the room. No, you finish your point.
I think it's this interesting thing. Like we saw this with everybody posting their Spotify Wrapped this year where everybody's like, oh, you could tell I was really going through it this year because these are my favorite songs. So like, oh, you mean the most listened to songs of the year? Yeah, really interesting emotional state you have. But also, I will say, this does sort of speak to this idea that a lot of this stuff is like, it's neutral enough emotional music that you can sort of take it and extrapolate it and say, this is where my life fits into these pieces. Like, I think that Taylor Swift is really good at that, right? She's really good at tapping into this sort of universal experience. It is a really hard thing. A lot of people have said, you can write a punk rock song. You can write a rock song. Writing pop music that millions of people will obsess about. So like your music will be so big that they'll shoot images of it on a statue of Jesus in Brazil. That is really, really, really hard to do. And I think that like me saying that she's giving you this blank canvas,
yeah,
that's not a detractment necessarily.
But I know you. I know enough about this opinion of yours at least.
Yeah.
Like you think she's got some
I'm not a medium Swifty, but you're not those medium Swifties are not in the room with us.
Oh, do you like Taylor Swift?
Oh my God, Nico. Okay. But here's the thing, is like as someone who has been a fan of Taylor Swift for like a long time and like a serious and studied fan, let's say.
Yeah.
I would say like this last year has been different. It's been different in a couple of ways. One is that it feels a bit like a victory lap because she's accomplished all these things, but also she's in the middle of these re-releases, right? Like the Taylor's versions of her albums in order to own her masters. And these projects are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, Speak Now, which is my favorite Taylor Swift album, she released that to almost no promotion whatsoever. And she broke records with the re-release of that one, which was kind of nuts. And then the other thing I would say is that like the reason that the tour was big was because she had four albums that she had not yet toured, partly because of the pandemic. She had Lover, which she put on in 2019. She was going to tour in 2020, and then the pandemic shut that down. She had Folklore and Evermore both come out in 2020. And then she had Midnights, which came out last year. And like there's the demand for Taylor was kind of bursting at the seams because she did continue to give you all of that music over that period of time, but hadn't had a chance to tour it. So when she does, it's like 70,000 person stadiums every night, but three nights per city. Yeah. And he was this massive juggernaut that he was.
I'm gonna cap the Taylor Swift. How dare I?
I feel silenced, but it's fine.
Good. I'm glad you're getting the message. No. What I wanted to mention, though, is that, you know, we've got these two big juggernauts, but there's everyone else, right? So it's not been a great year for other working musicians. I'm just thinking Bandcamp laid off half its staff. Mm-hmm. Going forward into the year, people who are streaming on services like Spotify are looking like they're in more trouble. So, mm-hmm. Nico, next year is not going to be great. It looks like it's going to get tougher for smaller artists, right?
Yeah, I mean, we are facing this already. We have been facing this for a while. And it is, like you said, it's only going to get worse. You know, Spotify, they're not, if you're streamed under 1,000 times, you won't be getting paid out the minuscule amount you'll ever get paid out. And like, there's a lot of oxygen mm-hmm. in the room for these top earners, right? Like, if you're in a certain percentile of artists on Spotify, you're doing okay. But everybody else is sort of losing out. And we're slowly moving into this space where, you know, like, you sort of need to exist in these, with these digital service providers in order to just reach an mm-hmm. audience. And, you know, like, losing Bandcamp or something like that, you know, like, this was a good place for niche artists, for, like, especially people that do soundtrack work, video game soundtrack mm-hmm. work, especially. Mm-hmm. Like, those things are big on Bandcamp. And they're big on Spotify mm-hmm. too, but it's a different landscape there. And so now it's making it harder for these other artists to sort of carve out their niche places in the world. And like, yes, there's always workarounds and there's always other places for people to access this stuff. But like, you need to have like something that people can easily use so you can get this sort of mass user base. And, you know, it's going to be harder and harder and harder for artists that are on Spotify or whatever to like actually make money for their work.
I'm going to move on to TV. So 2023 was a big year for series finales. Award-winning critical darlings and fan favorites like Ted Lasso, Barry, Reservation Dogs, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and of course, a show called Succession.
It doesn't even make any sense! I'm the eldest boy!
They all ended their runs. Elamine, do you think it's been a good year for television?
Yeah, I would say that... on balance, some really significant shows ended in ways that felt fulfilling, you know? People talk a lot about how short the run for Reservation Dogs was, but also people talk a lot about how they appreciated that a show can end, you know, with the creators in control of that. Mm-hmm. We should say that Succession is ending. HBO did not want it to end, but we knew that the creators were like, this is a story that we're trying to tell. And to my mind, you know, Succession will be remembered in the 2020s, the same way they remember The Sopranos in the early aughts. So, like, I think there's a real sort of, hey, this is prestige television at its highest quality. And we kind of, like, all saw, we witnessed something really special, you know, that last shot of Kendall Roy and his face. He's never going to leave me after everything he's been through, you know, my number one boy. And so I think a lot about the way that Succession ended as like, I'm really grateful for the television that we got this year.
Nico?
It's interesting because we talk a lot about Succession and like, and I do have this sort of, I have this long theory about a monoculture and the way we're getting worse and worse about it. And like, you know, Succession became this language that everybody spoke if they watched it. And like for people like me who actually didn't watch the show, you know, you sort of feel like you're left out of the conversation because you don't speak the memes or you don't do all this stuff. But we did, you know, all these shows did, like this idea of like Reservation Dogs did get to end on its own terms and told a complete story that was really beautiful. And like, you know, Justified came back and Marvelous Mrs. Maisel ended its run, which was like a show that a lot of people didn't necessarily talk about, but was really good, had a lot of really solid actors and writers on it and told a really complete story that ended without going on too long. And like, and I know that this was a thing for Succession and like this, what it is a really good time for TV. Like TV, we've seen this happen over the last couple of years. Like TV has kind of taken away from movies in terms of like, you know, prestige storytelling vehicles, but also like, I do hope we get back into more like stuff that has like 22 episodes a season and it doesn't, you don't get it all at once. And like, I also do want us to be able to get back to more like a popcorn McDonald's-y sort of like, I want like a neutral thing that's just like comforting and nice, but doesn't have to, I don't need everything to mean something all the time. And I worry that sometimes there's this like desire for everything to mean something important, right? And like, and that's all well and fine, but like not everything needs to be important. Sometimes things can just be.
Sometimes you just want to just like, I don't want to think. I don't want homework for television. I just want to enjoy myself.
I just want two things, Law and Order.
The other big story in entertainment this year was, of course, the impact of the writers and actors strike. You mentioned that earlier. I mean, it was one of the longest work stoppages in Hollywood history. Do you think we felt the effects of the strike on TV?
We haven't felt them yet, I don't think. So some of the small effects that we've had has been that, like, you know, True Detective, which is like this, the next season of True Detective called Night Country, starring Jodie Foster, who's supposed to come out like this December. It's now coming out in January. Everything gets pushed back a little bit. Right. As a result, you end up seeing a show like The Gilded Age take up a prestigious 9 p.m. HBO slot that it never otherwise would have gotten. But also, all the shows that are supposed to come out on a certain schedule, that schedule has got to move maybe 3 months, maybe 4 months, maybe 6 months later. And so you'll start to see a little bit more reality TV that they commissioned during the strike start to hit your television the next little while.
All right. Nico, anything you want to add?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, thinking of this, like, how are we feeling the effects of it? I also think that, like, consumers of culture will hopefully walk away from this having a better understanding of what the people that make these things are, like, working for, what they're doing, what their conditions have been like, what their conditions will hopefully be like in the future. Like, getting a better understanding of the labor behind the things we consume is a net positive for people to, like, be really, like, to bear witness to. And I think that was a big part of it, is the strikes were so publicized and we saw people out there, and, like, and, you know, like, you and I, like, we had, like, friends that were on these strikes, right? And, like, and we could see all this stuff. And it is, like, I do think it's important for people to know that, like, people were really, like, weren't being served properly behind the scenes, and now we've given them a better opportunity to do so. So when people complain that, like, oh, we haven't gotten season two of Severance yet, well, that's because the people that make Severance needed to fight to actually be fairly compensated for their time and effort. And I think that's a good thing that we walk away with from that.
Okay, so before I let you guys go, one last question, super light one. Not a heavy one.
Oh boy.
Uh-oh.
We're in a post-pandemic world.
Yeah.
The cost of living is going up like crazy. There's a couple serious wars going on. We're paying a devastating price for climate change. So when we look back on the pop art consumed this year, what do you think we were collectively looking for?
I do think that there is this desire for something to make sense of all this, or for something to mean something. Like, this is a really hard question to answer, because I think everybody's going to take away something different from this era that we're living in right now. But I do think that there is this desire for one thing to mean everything, right? This is why this is part of my concern about this monoculture funnel that we're falling into, of, like, people are so desperate for this one thing to mean everything that you can hold onto like a life raft. When you look back, you can be like, that was the year we watched Succession and everything was okay. Because, like, ultimately culture really defines eras. We know this, like, from looking back, we know that, like, we can place time by what was going on in those eras. So I think it's just this desperate need for something to be important.
Well, one question I think about a lot, and, like, that I, like, try to incorporate a lot into my work, is, like, what do we need to know in common?
Yeah.
And also, what do we need to know in common in order for us to be a we at all? And with the way that culture is fragmenting, that question gets harder and harder to answer. You know, if you're living on, like, I don't know, Pavement Spotify, which I know you are, Nico, listening to Pavement all the time.
Sure.
And I'm listening to Taylor Swift all the time. I'm like, there's a fragmentation that starts to happen. And we go, like, do we still share the same world if we're consuming such different cultures? Which is why we look so desperately for those moments that are like, oh, we have the same cultural reference points.
Yeah.
I do think, actually, in a weird way, Oppenheimer will become that, not Barbie. I don't mean to be rude to Barbie. Barbie was a significant sort of cultural event, but Oppenheimer is trying to deal with certain questions that we are now beginning to ask, particularly with AI, for example, which is, like, the idea of, like, there are scientists who are only asking the question, hey, is it possible for it to be done? Can it be done? Let's do it. And then there's a sort of a wider world that's standing beside them being like, but should you do it?
Yeah.
Is that the right thing? Maybe you can find out that you can do it. By the time you find that out, will it be maybe too late? And that is a central question, you know, of Oppenheimer.
Yeah, that can I versus should I sort of argument is really, like, it's only getting louder and bigger and more present as the year sort of comes to a close.
Nico, Lameen, awesome to have you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Friend, this has been a delight. Thank you.
A real pleasure. All right, that's it for today. I'm Damon Fairless. Thanks for listening to Front Burner. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.